Tom Hall. This is the Midday News Wrap. In this third week of the Trump administration, a roller coaster ride of legal and political developments. President Trump had a major setback when a federal appeals court in San Francisco refused last night to reinstate his executive order banning travelers from seven Muslim-majority countries. The Republican-led Senate rolled over nearly unanimous Democratic opposition and confirmed four more cabinet picks. Partisan rancor in the Senate is at a new low, and Democrats meeting in Baltimore vowed continued resistance to the Trump agenda. Baltimore Mayor Catherine Pugh said she's looking for new ways to end a terrible surge in violence. We'll look at these and other developments this week with our News Wrap panel, Washington Post White House correspondent Jenna Johnson and Adar Ayira of Associated Black Charities. First, the news. And welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall on this chilly February Friday. I think it's still below 30 degrees out here at the international headquarters of WIPR. But I hope it is somewhat warm wherever you are. And if you know of somebody who doesn't have a place to be warm, why don't you check in on them and make sure that they're doing okay. Today is the Midday News Wrap. Today marks the end of the third week of the Trump administration, and there was no let-up in the controversies that the new president is generating. A federal appeals court ruling last night upheld a lower court's stay on the president's executive order, temporarily banning refugee admissions and travel to and from seven Muslim-majority countries. The president attacked the judges involved in that decision. His nominee to the Supreme Court called those attacks demoralizing. Betsy DeVos was confirmed as the new Secretary of Education. Her confirmation was historic for all the wrong reasons. Democrats convened at the Inner Harbor here in Baltimore, struggling with a strategy to counter the Republicans' dominance in D.C. And the city of Baltimore has begun the year more violently than in any year since the 1970s. Today on the News Wrap, we're joined by White House correspondent Jenna Johnson of The Washington Post. She joins us on the line from The Washington Post studios. Good afternoon, Jenna. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. And here with me in Studio A is Adar Ayira. She's the Director of Programs at Associated Black Charities. Welcome back to you as well. Always good to see you.
And you too.
We are looking forward to your questions, comments here on the Midday News Wrap. Our phone number at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. We were hoping to be joined today by Liz Copeland of the Urban Conservative Project. A last-minute thing came up with her. We do hope to eventually connect with John Fritzi, who's the national correspondent of the Baltimore Sun. But Jenna Johnson, let me start with you. If I understand it correctly, during the Trump campaign, which you covered for more than a year, you attended something like 170 rallies in 33 different states. Do I have those numbers right?
That's right. It was at least 170. And I think if you add in all of the press conferences and primary night parties and things like that, it was probably over 200.
And you wrote a piece in today's Post noting that the president, when he was a candidate and then when he was a president-elect, said that when he became the president, he would become somehow a different person. He would be more presidential. And several other prognosticators predicted that somehow Mr. Trump would undergo some major personality transformation when he assumed office. But you say basically that he has changed the presidency rather than the presidency changing him. What do you mean?
So he actually said that he would be so presidential that people would get bored. And I think the first 3 weeks have shown that no one is bored. Everyone is racing to keep up with everything that he's saying and doing. His presidency has been surrounded by just this cloud of chaos and just so many different statements flying around and executive orders being signed and things like that. And Trump and those close to him had made this promise on the campaign trail that he would be different. He even said that he might give up Twitter. And then he got elected. He got into the White House. And I think he hit this point where he realized, why change? And his press secretary even said yesterday, he's been this person for so long. This is the person that people elected. Why would he change? He's not going to stop being who he is. And so I, you know, maybe he will become so presidential that we all get bored. But he shows no signs of changing who he is.
Well, you're certainly right that boredom has not been our problem the last 3 weeks. Adar Ayira, I wonder if this chaotic nature, this chaotic vibe that continues to come out of the White House is kind of like crazy like a fox chaos. There are those who are suggesting that a lot of this is really purposeful, that it keeps people off guard, particularly his opponents in the Senate and the Congress, that having this level of, number one, this just the basic level of activity with so much stuff happening every day, it's hard to concentrate on the one or two things that you might want to pull out. But that the general scrum of chaos is a direct strategy. What do you think?
I don't know whether it's a direct strategy or not, but I think that that is irrelevant, because what we clearly see are patterns of behavior and patterns of policy, quite frankly. And if we don't start turning our attention toward that, then we will be doing a disservice to all of those people who are going to be and who are now impacted by the policies that he is not only proposing but doing. If you talk about immigration, that is moving forward, and thank God for the, or depending on what side of the fence you are, thank God or not, about the decisions that have come down. But the point is that people on the ground are hurting already, and their question is not whether he's being crazy like a fox or not. Their question is, who is next, and how do we resist?
And we're joined now on the phone from John Fritzy. He's the national correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. John, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate
you
being here.
How you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks. I wonder, do you think that Mr. Trump has transformed the presidency or that the presidency is in any way transforming him? And what do you think his transformational impact, if there is one, is on the Republican Party as an institution and as a party?
Well, I think those are all good questions. I think they are still open questions. I think certainly so far, Trump seems to be having a bigger impact on the presidency than vice versa, right? And I do think that, this has been an unusual and quick start to this White House. I was around in 08. That's the other one I covered. This is certainly a different tone, different tenor. And it's also, as I'm sure some of your guests have said, it is the tenor that came from the campaign, right? So I feel like the answer to the first question is that so far, I think that Trump is having the bigger impact on the presidency than the other way around. You know, I think the Republican, how it shapes the Republican is, you know, remains to be seen. You know, we're 20 days in, I think, roughly at this point, and there are clearly already tensions bubbling up. You know, when you have two Republicans pulling off on Betsy DeVos, Trump's nominee for the Education Department, for instance, and you have Trump going after John McCain again on Twitter, I was sort of struck by the fact that, you know, that was a 50-51 vote. Is it really the right time to be going after Republican senators while you're still looking to get your cabinet confirmed? So, I think that there is some tension there, and I suspect that if we continue on this path, that tension will come more to the fore and will play into a lot of things. There's a lot of stuff coming down the pike, federal funding being one of those, ACA repeal being another. And so there's a lot of places where Trump is going to need Republicans on the Hill in the way that he hasn't so far.
John Fritzy is the national correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. Adar Ayira of Associated Black Charities is with me here in the studio. Jenna Johnson is on the line from the headquarters of the Washington Post in D.C. You are welcome to join our conversation here at midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. And our Twitter handle, @midday. Tom Hall. So, Jenna Johnson, as you hang around the White House and talk to folks in the administration and talk to folks in Washington, what do you make of the purported camp battle between the two camps that a lot of people have articulated as Reince Priebus, who's Mr. Trump's chief of staff, and then Steve Bannon, who is one of Mr. Trump's senior advisors, another holdover, along with folks like Kellyanne Conway from the campaign. Do you buy into that notion that there are these two camps, one which sort of represents the establishment side, Reince Priebus, and the other that represents the more radical outsider side?
Yeah, there definitely are two camps. They've gone to great lengths to say that even though they have very different mindsets, they're the best of friends. Reince Priebus and Steve Bannon recently did this interview with New York Magazine where they just were very, very chummy on the phone, joking about giving each other back massages and being on the phone with each other until one falls asleep and things like that. So they have gone to great, great lengths to try to assure people that they get along and they like each other. But just their mindsets are so very different. You have Priebus, who was the leader of the Republican Party. He is the establishment. He knows how things get done. He knows the order of things. He knows how to bring people together and to get along and things like that. And so his approach to any problem is going to be the traditional approach. And then you have Steve Bannon, who prides himself on being a disruptor. He ran Breitbart for a long time and became known as this person who liked stirring up controversy and throwing out headlines that would get people talking. So just their two mindsets are so at odds. And that's obviously going to set up a situation where there's going to be tension and disagreement about how they should be doing things.
I mean, what do we read into an apparent effort, at least, to put on the face of comity and good relations if they're giving those kinds of interviews and stuff? I mean, they would, I'm sure, point to that as saying, oh, this is kumbaya, my lord, everybody's getting along. But, you know, no one's buying it. I mean, Trump, the great salesperson, can't sell that.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, things are chaotic and no White House wants to have that reputation of being a disaster or being a mess or of not thinking through problems. So by presenting this narrative that everyone's getting along and on the same page, I think they're trying to kind of hide some of the problems that have blown up. And the executive order on immigration is an excellent example of this. I mean, this is an executive order that came together with a very small group of people, some people working on it kind of in secret without telling their bosses on the Hill about it. And there were a lot of problems that appear to just have not been thought through, like how are green card holders going to be handled? The first week that this order went into place, the White House was all over the place. You had Reince Priebus saying one thing. You had White House aides saying another thing about if this applied to green card holders or not. It just seemed like no one was on the same page. And that's not the image that you want to be giving to the American public in your first 3 weeks in office.
And Adar Ayira, it does seem, and many people have commented, that during these first 3 weeks of the administration, Trump appears to still be kind of on the campaign trail. Right. And that these events are kind of like the ones that Jenna attended 200 plus times.
Yes. And I think that that's the difference between campaign and policy. That when you are campaigning, you're throwing out what sells to the crowd. When you are developing and implementing policy, you have to pay more attention because it impacts lives in a way that what you say during the campaign doesn't. I don't know that they have made that transition yet. And the question is, will they be able to, especially with it seemingly being a very insular environment, which is not very open to actually talking to those colleagues of theirs who know what is going on and how government works.
Got to take a little break. Our panel today on the news on the Midday News Wrap, Jenna Johnson, the White House correspondent, or a White House correspondent for The Washington Post, Adar Ayira of Associated Black Charities, and John Fritzy of the Baltimore Sun. We'd be delighted to have you join our conversation. 410-662-8780 is our number here at Midday, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. We'll be back with more of the news of the week in 90 seconds. Stick around.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday here on Midday, the Syrian refugee crisis. I'll be joined by the director of the Refugee Rights Program at Human Rights Watch, as well as leaders of Catholic Relief Services and the Lutheran Immigration and Relief Service. Also, the filmmaker and author David Simon will be here. He'll talk about what he and Taylor Branch and DeRay McKesson, Steve Earle, and many others are doing to help people affected by the Trump administration's proposed travel ban from seven Muslim-majority nations. That's coming up Monday here on Midday. If you've just joined us today, it's the Midday News Wrap. I'm joined here in the studio by A. Adar Ayira. She's the director of programs at the Associated Black Charities. John Fritzy joins us from his office in Baltimore. He's the national correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. And joining us on the line from Washington is Washington Post reporter Jenna Johnson, who covered Donald Trump during the 2016 presidential campaign and now covers him at his new address. If you would like to join our conversation, 410-662-8780 is the number to call. Our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Jenna Johnson, I wanted to ask you about leaks in the White House. There's been a lot of attention paid to the fact that so-called private conversations have been made public or at least summarized by anonymous sources in the White House. Is this White House leakier than the Obama White House or the Bush White House or the Clinton White House, to your knowledge? Should we make anything of the fact that we talked about the camps, the Priebus camp versus the Bannon camp. Is that playing out in the way they are dealing with the press?
Well, for it only being 3 weeks in, this seems like a very leaky White House. Typically, this early in an administration, most staffers are wanting to just find their way around, get working, help the team, and not get into trouble by sharing information with reporters. But there's been a lot of information coming out of the White House and people with ties to the White House. I think one thing to keep in mind on this is that a lot of these leaks have been embarrassing to the president, and there are some that seem embarrassing to the president, but are actually things that perhaps the White House wants out there. An example of that would be the call that the president had with Australia's prime minister, in which he basically hung up halfway through as they fought over what was going to happen to a group of refugees that Australia is paying to house on some impoverished Pacific islands right now. A lot of people look at that story and say, oh, that's so embarrassing. This shows Trump's temper. And how could he do this to a country like Australia? But once that news came out, it didn't seem like people at the White House were that upset that it got out there. To them, this shows that Trump is a strong leader and that he's not afraid to go after anyone, even a friendly country like Australia.
And John Fritzy, it really is quite fascinating when Mr. Trump does things that appear to be very popular with his base. He doesn't seem to be making particular overtures to anybody else. And there have been numerous examples of repercussions of that. Locally, for example, Kevin Plank, the CEO and founder of Under Armour, got a fair amount of blowback when he made some comments laudatory of President Trump as a president who could be good for business. I mean, some of his biggest endorsers, Stephen Curry, the basketball player, Misty Copeland, the ballerina, had some pretty harsh things to say about Mr. Plank. So folks have to be careful what they say and the way they position themselves with Mr. Trump, don't they?
Yeah, they do. And, you know, one of the interesting things about the opening weeks of this administration is the president's willingness and ability to go after individual companies, which is something that we hadn't seen very much, if at all, during the Obama administration. And so, the situation with Nordstrom this week is an example of that, obviously. Plank, I do think that companies are having to be very careful about anything they say, including things that maybe aren't really political, but could be perceived as political.
And Adar Ahira, another controversy concerning Governor Hogan had to do with his Facebook page. There were people calling on him to denounce the travel ban that the Trump administration tried to put in place last week. And when he didn't, number one, they were upset about that. And number two, he banned them from his Facebook page. He actually took people off and refused to let them post anything else, calling them spam. That sets an interesting tone here at home, doesn't it?
You know, and I think that a lot of policymakers are going to be in that position of trying to walk a line between their relationship with this new administration and their relationship with constituencies. So it will be interesting to see how that plays out. But one thing that is being lost in this is that it's not just about a pattern of behavior from the White House. Again, it is about the effect of that pattern of behavior on different constituencies that are not his base. And regardless of whether a policymaker is Republican or Democrat, if they are serving the people, then they have to serve not some of the people, but keep in mind the pain and the impact on all of the people. And it will be interesting to see how many policymakers understand and remember that, and how many policymakers are ready to throw people under the bus and follow the pattern of an administration.
Adar Ahira is from the Associated Black Charities. She's here in the studio. Jenna Johnson's on the line from D.C. She's a White House correspondent for The Washington Post. And John Fritzy joins us on the phone. He's the national correspondent for The Baltimore Sun. 410-662-8780 is our number. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Lots of folks lined up on the phone. Let's go to Abdul in Baltimore. Abdul, welcome to the news wrap. Appreciate your call.
I'd like to ask Adari if she agrees that the African-American community is suffering and will suffer for a little while, almost like a postpartum depression after Obama. Sociologists would agree that African-Americans don't kill themselves at the same rate as others, but we do turn on each other. And I think that the high or the spike in crime in Baltimore, where I am, is going to be symptomatic of a post-Obama era. And I'd like to hear Adara's comments on that. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for your call, Abdul. That's interesting, linking the spike in crime in Baltimore to a sort of post-Obama depression.
Thank you, Abdul. I am often asked the question, how can we stop crime? How can we lower crime? And what I always say is that we can lower crimes by opportunity and access to education and to jobs. And maybe if there is a postpartum depression, it is because we see that those opportunities and that focus is not going to be a focus of, or seemingly not a focus of, the present administration. And that, again, we are all going to suffer because of that, not just for the next 4 years, but if there are policies coming from the Supreme Court and policies that another president will not be able to overturn, we're going to suffer for years and years and years and years to come.
And John Fritzy, when it comes to things like the murder rate, which we've got now, we're basically almost one a day here in Baltimore. But President Trump weighed in on the crime rate, and he weighed in a way that was completely factually inaccurate. He talked a few days ago about a murder rate overall in the country that's 47% higher, and in fact, it's about exactly the opposite of that. As a reporter covering the national scene, how do you deal with that? How do you parse that for your readers?
Well, I think we just pointed out. I mean, as we did in a story we wrote today, Trump signed 3 executive orders on policing, which really didn't amount to much. And I think it's actually a fascinating story because Trump, throughout the campaign and then early in the White House, has been very aggressive in his rhetoric on dealing with law and order issues. But when these orders came out yesterday, when we finally got to see him, which takes a little while after the signing, which is also unusual, they didn't amount to much. You know, there wasn't a whole lot in there that was tangible in terms of actual changes that he wants to do. Now, a little bit of that, I think, is because there's a limit to what a president can do with an executive order, right? And a little bit of it is that policing is pretty much a purview, a function of local government, not really of Washington. But I do think it's interesting that, he has been very, really made this an issue and has been very aggressive on law and order. And then these first orders, didn't really do a whole lot. I will say this. I mean, on the crime stats, it's clearly wrong. And I think we and others, other journalists have just pointed it out. But I'll also note that message the resonance is a little bit different in a place like Baltimore or Chicago, right? It is absolutely the case that crime is down. The murder rate is down from the 1990s. But that argument is a little bit harder to hear in a place like Baltimore where it appears to be going up.
John Fritzy from the Baltimore Sun, Jenna Johnson from the Washington Post, and Nadar Ayira join us here on the Midday News Wrap. 410-662-8780, our email address, midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Adar, before we go back to the phones, a quick one more comment about crime.
Thank you. So, and John hit on this with the whole law and order focus, and this gets to Abdul's point, too. With that focus, our president has said repeatedly that Baltimore, that Chicago, that New York, places where he has racialized crime, right, and in a very specific way, that he was going to crack down on that. That sends a message to local policing, too. It sends a message to our cities about what will be tolerated and what can be done to people who live in those cities. And so we have to pay attention to the meta conversation. That conversation is not on the surface, but that conversation that has history and context, and again, that impacts people who have been historically marginalized.
Well, let's remind folks, too, that the murder rate here in Baltimore, if you calculate it per 100,000 people, is 4 times that of New York. 4 times, and it's almost double that of Chicago. We hear a lot about Chicago and the number of murders they have, but of course they have many, many more people. So if you parse it in a particular way, it's very, very scary. Let's go back to the phones. John in East Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I wanted to question the continued use of the word radical. In your opening, you described the two forces in the White House, perhaps Priebus and Steve Bannon. And I think if we continue to use the word radical to describe Stephen Bannon and his acolytes, we're actually misleading people. It doesn't actually tell people the reality, which is that Bannon and his like are racist provocateurs and xenophobic and sexist. And their actions and attitudes and words, certainly Bannon's words via Breitbart, demonstrate that. So I would like to hear why we continue, and it's not just you, Tom, it's being used throughout the media, describing Bannon as radical. Why use that term and not really call it what it is?
Well, before I respond to that, and I'm happy to do that, Jenna Johnson, it seems to me that Mr. Bannon wears those terms as encomiums. You know, I mean, he wears them as a point of honor to be called radical or a demagogue or, alt-right. He's not shying away from those characterizations, is he?
No. I mean, these are words that he has used himself in trying to explain Breitbart to the rest of the world. And, John, I understand your frustration, and I hear this frustration every day on Twitter from readers who are saying, why don't you call the president a liar? Why don't you call Stephen Bannon a racist? And, I mean, with each story, we approach each set of facts as best we can. and we present what people have said and what they have done to the public, and we allow them to form their conclusions. The biggest controversy right now is the word lie. There are a lot of people who want reporters to label the president a liar and to say that he has lied. The thing with that word is that you have to be able to prove that there was an intent to deceive, that someone knew this information was wrong and shared it because they wanted to deceive people. In a lot of cases with the president, I don't know if that's true or not. I think there are some false things that he says that he could actually believe are true, and he's spreading these falsehoods. So again, and there are different cases, and you know, there are times that we will use these labels, but a lot of times I think the best thing reporters can do is present the information clearly and directly and allow readers to form their own conclusions.
And it's interesting that reporters, and I certainly hope that I'm one of them, try very hard to be very specific and very correct in our usage of any adjective or any verb to talk about any public issue or any public figure. And much has been made and much comment has been made about the Trump administration's, you know, seemingly lack of concern, for what language means. And Jenna makes a good point here about the word lie. For example, the other day, before the Ninth Circuit court ruling came down last night, Mr. Trump said, "I don't ever want to call a court biased, so I won't call it biased. We haven't had a decision yet, but the courts seem to be so political, and it would be great for our justice system if they'd be able to read a statement and do what's right." So when he says, "I don't ever want to call a court biased," he spent weeks on the campaign calling Judge Curiel a biased judge because of his Mexican heritage. So it's just, I mean, that's, Jenna, that's one of those interesting ones. Or John Fritz, let me throw that to you. I mean, that. Is that a lie? He's just being forgetful? Is he just trying to rewrite history? I mean, what's that all about?
Well, it's certainly hard to read a lot into some of these tweets because the message does seem to shift around a lot. I think Jenna hit the nail on the head. I think that we typically are very cautious about applying labels like that, and I think we're far better serving our readers by just sort of laying out the facts as best we can. And certainly, you know, I mean, you know, we talked about this, the crime thing. I mean, that was an example where I think everybody did that. And I think, you know, we let readers sort of decide how they want to characterize it.
Adar?
So, I have seen media. I have read stories. I think that we all have. When you have seen people characterized or mischaracterized, if it is someone who is a black person who has committed a crime, and the way that they are characterized in the media, or suspected of committing a crime and the way that they're characterized by the media, we are being a lot more careful in parsing out why we are saying or not saying something about the president.
Give me an example of that kind
of thing. So even, you know, in reporting people as thugs, right? That's an example. Or about when we are talking about Trayvon Martin, for instance, and we're reading about how he got into trouble and how he did this and how he did that, which has nothing and had nothing to do with what happened to him. So there are a lot of ways in which the media parses for some people without doing affording other people the same courtesy. And I think that we cannot get past the acknowledging the reality that most of our mainstream media are people who are privileged in terms of class, in terms of education, in terms of race. And that when you look at and read about or listen to media from an African-American community or a Latino community or other, what you hear are people putting facts out as facts without parsing and without drinking the Kool-Aid of alternative facts.
We got a great panel for you here today on the Midday News Watch. That's Adar Ayer. She's the director of programs at Associated Black Charities. Jenna Johnson joins us from the Washington Post, where she covers the White House. And John Fritzi is the national correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. He's on the line. We'd like to have you on the line as well when we come back from a quick break. 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. If you want to drop us a tweet, @MiddayTomHall is our handle. Stick around. We'll be right back.
This is your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
It's a political decision, and we're going to see them in court, and I look forward to doing it.
So you believe the judges made a political
decision?
We
have a situation where the security of our country is at stake, and it's a very, very serious situation. So we look forward, as I just said, to seeing them in court.
President Donald Trump responding to the decision by the Ninth Circuit regarding his proposed travel ban on people from seven different Muslim-majority countries. With us today for the Midday News Wrap, Jenna Johnson. She's the White House correspondent for The Washington Post. She covered Donald Trump during the 2016 presidential campaign and now covers him at the White House. She's one of several correspondents for The Post covering the Trump administration, and she joins us on the line from Washington. Here in the studio, Adar Ayer. She's the director of programs at Associated Black Charities, and on the phone from his office in Baltimore, John Fritzi, the national correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. You want to drop us a tweet, our handle is @MiddayTomHall, or email midday@wypr.org. Jenna, before we go back to the phones, let me ask you to expound a little bit about how that executive order was put together and the secrecy that people have commented about in the process that they used to put it together. Did it show some sort of political naivete in that it was not inclusive of people who perhaps would have been best served had they known about it in advance? What's your take on that?
Well, it was a very small group that was working on this. There's this guy named Stephen Miller, who used to work for Jeff Sessions on the Hill and is very well versed in immigration issues and has been with Donald Trump for months and months, and was really a driving force behind a lot of his immigration stances. He was taking a big role in this. Stephen Bannon was taking a big role in this. And they also had some staffers from the Hill who specialize in immigration who were also helping out on it, a lot of times without telling their bosses or Republican leadership that they were working on this. And the White House says that it got all of the sign-offs that it needed. Now, as far as how much input different agencies got to have is up for debate. There are a lot of people, even in Donald Trump's cabinet, who felt like they really got caught off guard on this, or just as they were starting to review it, the president was signing it. And there are a lot of Republicans on the Hill who are very critical of how this came together and said that if they had a chance to weigh in, or if different people at agencies had a chance to weigh in, especially people who have a deep understanding of how people come in and out of the country and just what problems might come up, so that they could kind of head off a lot of the confusion that happened and also prepare themselves for these court battles and these lawsuits that have come as a result.
Let's go to the phones. Frank in Aberdeen, you've been very patient. I appreciate that. Welcome to Midday.
Good afternoon. I want to talk about communication between the general public in the White House and to Congress. Obama used to have a line where you could call the White House. It was a White House comment line. That's now been shut down. Earlier today, I called the main number and I was trying to get to someone to give a comment, and I was told, no, there's nobody you could talk to. You need to either write a letter or send an email.
So you called the main number of the White House?
For the White House.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no way for you to, by phone, contact the White House. The other thing is, for 8 years, I have been calling the Speaker of the House,
John Boehner, and then Paul Ryan.
It's not always critical. It was oftentimes I would call to thank them when on the rare occasions when there was working with the White House. In any event, in the last week, there's now a number block on my phone. So when I call Paul Ryan's number, 202-225-3500, I get a busy signal. So I just wanted to let you know that they are actually shutting out the American public from even talking to them.
Well, thank you for your call and that perspective, Frank. John Fritzi, what's been your experience with the Trump administration so far in terms of their dealings with the media? The Obama administration, for example, was criticized by the White House Correspondents Association, certainly in his first term, for being inaccessible and difficult to get to in terms of the press. Do you have a sense that both with the press and the general public that the Trump administration is any less or more accessible?
Well, it sounds like that maybe the caller needs to get on Twitter. Maybe Twitter is the new phone. Maybe that's the best way to reach folks at the White House. I don't know for sure. But I do think, look, the Hill has experienced an incredible volume of calls, both Republicans and Democrats. You know, we've got a mostly Democratic delegation. I know it's been very hard for people to get through, in part because there's been a great number of people calling up to complain about folks' votes on these nominees, for instance. You know, and I also think, you know, just broadly, to be fair, you know, we are only 3 weeks in. I know that when the ban came out, when the temporary travel ban came out, you know, there were those of us trying to reach press folks at DHS, for instance, and it's not at the Department of Homeland Security, and it's not clear to me that those folks were really even in place yet. That night, we had a reporter who called, and basically it went to a voicemail, and the voicemail said that the voicemail was full and couldn't take any more calls. And so I think, you know, part of it is natural in a transition that it takes a little while for them to work these things up. Part of it is that, you know, there's a lot going on. Trump's doing a lot very early on. A lot of people are getting fired up, and you see that reflected in these town halls with huge turnouts and stuff. From a press perspective, you know, it's a little different. I'd be interested in Jenna's take on this. For the Sun, as a single person, you know, a single person bureau in Washington, it's definitely a lot harder. I get the sense that the Trump administration so far is not particularly concerned about Metro papers. They're very focused on national media. You know, just one example of that is that the Obama administration had a team in place that dealt with what we call regional press, which is the Sun, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, you know, mid-sized cities, and they were very good at sort of working with us on things like that. Trump doesn't have that yet, although I have been told that they are planning to do that. It's just, again, that things are sort of getting up to speed. And so, you know, my sense is that it might be a little bit early to ding them on press access, but certainly, you know, there have been some issues, as Jenna knows. You know, these briefings seem to be getting shorter and shorter, the daily briefings with Sean Spicer. But I think, there's obviously with Trump, there's a part of his thing is to have this adversarial relationship. That's part of what fires up his base. And so, but I think how that plays out, you know, is still a little bit unclear.
Mm-hmm. And Jenna Johnson, while you were on the campaign trail, I recall with great acuity the fact that the Trump administration made a big deal about barring the Washington Post, you and your colleagues, from all of their campaign events. And, of course, your coverage of the campaign continued. Has the tenor of the relationship between the Trump administration and the national media, like the Post, like the New York Times, like the Wall Street Journal, do you sense any change between the campaign and now that they're in office?
Well, I think both sides are trying to give each other a chance and trying to have a professional working relationship. On the campaign trail, a big frustration of reporters is that the president or the candidate at that point would say something and you would reach out to the campaign to try to figure out what he meant. and you just get silence back. You know, I mean,
maybe they didn't know.
Really been a history. Yeah, there hasn't really been a history of answering questions or explaining or providing context. It's a little bit harder for them to do that now that all the reporters are at the White House and can chase them down in a hallway and things like that. A big part of Donald Trump's rallies was pointing at reporters in the back of the room.
Sure.
And saying, these people are terrible. They're dishonest. He and Steve Bannon have both labeled the press the opposition party. So there's definitely a tension there. We're just going to have to see how this plays out.
Let's go back to the phone. Just have a few minutes left here on Midday. John in Phoenix, welcome to Midday with Adar Ayira, Jenna Johnson, and John Fritzy.
Yes. I find it odd, or maybe not so odd. They're probably using each other. The Senate on these cabinet appointments and the president. And he was... they were running and hiding during the campaign because he was such an embarrassment and they didn't agree with what he said, that he was unfit to serve, et cetera, et cetera. And then they all rolled over and voted straight party line on every one of these things, with the exception of the two senators on DeVos. So the Republican collective is just as dangerous as Trump, in my mind.
Well, thanks for your comment, Adar Ayira. Jason Chavitz, who is a Republican from a conservative district in Utah, presiding over a pretty rowdy town meeting that he had, that where folks are demanding that he investigate ethical allegations against Trump and members of his family. Betsy DeVos, the newly appointed Secretary of Education, was greeted with protesters when she made an appearance at a school in D.C. Yesterday, I guess. Are these things harbingers of things to come?
I think so. And one interesting thing from that rally was the chant of do your job, do your job. And I think that the American people have to hold the policymakers accountable, the president accountable, and also the media accountable. Because if we are just depending on communication from the president via his Twitter, then it is just that one person who gets to set the narrative and who knows what we will be told. The media plays an important role in the checks and balances and narrative, as well as letting the public know what's going on so that the public can understand what or at least assess what truth is. So the media also has a job to do in all of this, as do the public in holding this administration accountable.
Jenna Johnson, let me give you the last word. We have about 30 seconds. I want to talk about Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch talking in a very disparaging way about the person who's nominated him for the court, calling Mr. Trump's remarks before and after now this Ninth Circuit Court decision demoralizing. What do you make of that, and what do you think that might, how might that inform his chances of being confirmed?
Well, we haven't seen something like this before, where you have a nominee taking such a strong stance against something that a president has said. But you also haven't heard a president who has attacked federal judges in the way that Donald Trump has. And so this was really a moment for him to take a stand and to show where he stands on these things.
Yeah. Interesting
we'll
moment
see
indeed.
If this, yeah, we'll see if it impacts it or not.
We will indeed. Adar Ayira is the Director of Programs at the Associated Black Charities and one of the driving forces behind Baltimore Racial Justice Action. Jenna Johnson has joined us from D.C. She's a White House correspondent for The Washington Post. And John Fritzy is a national correspondent for The Baltimore Sun. Thanks to all of you. Much appreciated. Very much appreciated indeed. Thanks.
Thank you.
That'll do it for this edition of the Midday News Wrap. Coming up Monday on the show, we'll examine the Syrian refugee crisis. We'll talk to folks from the Lutheran and Catholic Relief Services, as well as a representative from Human Rights Watch, and David Simon, the creator of The Wire, many other acclaimed, critically acclaimed television shows. He'll join me to talk about what he and others are doing to oppose the Trump travel ban. By the way, on the show next Tuesday, it's Midday with the Mayor. Mayor Catherine Pugh will be my guest for the hour. She'll take your questions and comments. And a week from today, next Friday, my guest will be former Senator Barbara Mikulski. Coming up at the top of the hour, NPR will bring you live coverage of a press conference with President Donald Trump and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe from the East Room of the White House. That's coming right up right here on 88.1 WIPR. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknall. The show is produced by Rob Sivak. Bridget Armstrong and Kathleen Cahill. Austin Coglin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. Charlie Hines provides production assistance. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you Monday. Have a great weekend.